93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
And what I think I'm most interested in is stories about adults. When I made the first solo record, Clear Heart, Full Eyes, I was down in Austin making it, and I rented a car. And because I was in Texas, I started listening to like pop country radio. And I was really blown away by how many songs there were on that station that dealt with real things. There was one about a woman who had breast cancer. There was songs about people who had children in Iraq. Rock songs don't always do that, and I think that that's something that I'm really interested in right now.
If you're down and down, if you still have any doubts, we can tell that there's a savior yet to come.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast, presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. My guest today is Craig Finn. You may know him from The Hold Steady. You may know him from Lifter Puller. You may know him from the last couple of solo records that he just put out. He's long been one of my favorite songwriters, and it was great to have him on the podcast. I have interviewed him before, and I knew he was a great interview, but this podcast turned out even better than I could have expected. I actually hooked up with Craig when he was here in Minneapolis a couple of weeks ago. He played a show at the Basilica Block Party. He was playing there with Ryan Adams. That was a great show. And of course, if you know me, you know that a bill with Ryan Adams and Craig Finn is basically like Haydn-palooza. You know, this was like an ideal lineup for me. So yeah, I talked with Craig. It was a couple of days before that show, and it was a really fun conversation. It was a pretty wide-ranging conversation. The Hold Steady, of course, they're going to be touring a little bit later on this year. It's really not so much of a full-fledged tour. They're just playing sort of a small number of dates to recognize the 10-year anniversary of Boys and Girls in America, which I think for a lot of Hold Steady fans is sort of the ultimate Hold Steady record. And to make this tour even a little bit more special, they've reunited with their keyboardist, Franz Nicolay, who was a huge part of those sort of classic Hold Steady records in the mid to late 2000s. So when I talked to Craig, those shows had been announced not too much before, and people were very excited. So we talked a lot about that record. We talked a lot about the Hold Steady's career. We also talked about his solo career and what it's been like to age as a songwriter. You, of course, know Craig Finn is known for these great party anthems with the Hold Steady. But in his solo career, he's been moving in more of a thoughtful direction. I guess you could say a more adult-oriented direction. And of course, that is a path that has always been difficult for rockers to make as they get older. So it was great to talk to Craig about that. Craig, of course, like I said, he's a great interview. He's very thoughtful, but he's also very honest. And I think you'll find if you're a Hold Steady fan, this is an interesting conversation because he's very honest about what he feels are that band's strengths and weaknesses and what he feels are the band's best records and also records that maybe weren't as good. So it was great to get his input on that. And yeah, I think I've done enough talking. Why don't we get to the interview? Here's my conversation with Craig Finn. So yeah, so we're in a house in Northeast Minneapolis, and you're rehearsing this week with your solo band. Are you just doing this show, or are you doing solo dates after this?
I'm doing, on Friday, Des Moines, the 8035 Festival in Des Moines, okay. The Basilica Block Party here in Minneapolis, and then the West Fest, it's called, in Chicago. So it's a weekend Midwestern trip, and I've been out here this week visiting my family and whatnot.
Yeah. So, like, this would have been good promotion, like, but these dates will all be, like, 2 weeks or 3 weeks old by the time this posts.
Yeah, that's all right. I have a feeling they're going to go great, so.
Right. You know, so, yeah, hopefully there won't be, like, a huge, like tent accident or stage collapse or something. We'd have to edit this podcast if that occurs. So.
It'll be the, or it would be the one, you know, just before. The last just before.
Right.
The last pre-tent collapse.
So so you're playing these solo dates. What are you up to right now? I know you have these Hold Steady, you have a couple Hold Steady shows coming up. I think about a half dozen there were or so. Are you writing songs right now? Do you have any projects in the works, or are you just playing some shows right now?
I just finished my third solo album, which is which will come out, I'm hoping, in I don't have a release date, but I expect like early 17. I made it with upstate and sort of with a similar crew that I made Faith in the Future with. Josh Kaufman produced and played a lot on it. We played with a little more of a band, but we did, you know, it's like 16 songs. And I found it, you know, I wanted to come out with something with just Craig Finn quickly, you know, to sort of, you know, because it's, I feel very much like this is the thing, you know, it's not like a lesser thing or anything. And I write a lot. You know, I probably wrote 50 songs in the last year. So I like moving at that. And I think that the cool thing about the solo thing is it kind of allows you to move. It allows me to move at the pace that I want to move at without sort of, you know, there's things about a band that obviously a good band is better than the sum of their parts. Yeah. And I very much believe that. But at the same time, there's less taking care of things or politics or anything. It's sort of like, hey, do you want to play on this? You know, you can play on it. And that's been liberating and allowed me to make a lot of music in the past 2 years. And this is a record I'm really excited about. So that'll come out in early 2017, just because, as you said, the Hold Steady's playing a lot of shows. A handful of shows this fall. And it just seems like disruptive. I think an outsider might say it's confusing, you know, that to have a solo thing and then playing shows with the band and whatnot. But it allows me to be as creative as I want to be, which is, again, I want to move fast. And I also like playing with different people. And I very much value both things.
Yeah. So you said that you wrote 50 songs, and that was like 50 songs before this third record. Or did you have like 50 songs in the can?
50 songs that we pulled from to make the third record, and we recorded about 16, and probably 10 will be on the album. You know, I'm still kind of figuring out the final sequence, and then, you know, there's always odds and ends, B-sides, whatnot.
Is that just because you feel like you're not writing for the band? Like, do you feel like it's maybe easier to write songs because there's a little bit more freedom in that regard? Or, like, what accounts for that explosion?
I think so. I think, you know, I mean, I'm able to sit down and write every day, you know, so it's, you know, John Darnielle pointed out to me at one point, my friend John, who is obviously a prolific songwriter in the Mountain Goats, it's really not, if you have any kind of work ethic, a song a day isn't like that massive of an accomplishment. You know, you're not saying it's the best song ever. You're saying it's a song, right? Hopefully it's good, but if you write 50, you know, hopefully 10 of them are good.
You shouldn't say that because I was very impressed by 50. I've never written a song, so it seems very difficult to me.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess you could start more than that. But I guess my process has become, especially with the solo thing, is to try to write a song and then try to make it good or great. But the idea, maybe, you know, you're a writer, maybe getting something down on paper is the first thing, and then editing it, moving things around and saying that second verse sucks, I'm going to get rid of it. And maybe putting it aside for 2 weeks and revisiting it and kind of picking away at it. But if you have a blank page, it sucks, you know? I mean, anything I've tried to write, essay or whatever, it seems like it goes a lot better if you just get something down and then push at it. And that's, I think, similar to songs. But I guess, you know, with a band, like the Hold Steady, who's been around for 12 years, and is very much a band. So, you know, the way we've written and do things, it's kind of dependent on getting everyone in the room. And as people get older, that gets, you know, more complex. And Steve, for instance, lives in Memphis. And so with the solo thing, it's kind of can come from, like, I think it's good to being recorded quicker.
I've interviewed a bunch of, you know, artists who are, you know, in bands, but then they've also done records outside of those bands, and this idea of like the side project has come up. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, I've talked to some people who like hate that term because they feel like it's sort of inherently like a pejorative thing, that you have your main thing and your side thing, and your side thing is sort of, it's implied that it's maybe secondary. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people are, you know, they don't really care. Like, do you have any feelings about that at all in terms of your own work?
Well, you always love what you're working on. So, I mean, I think, like, for Faith in the Future, you know, especially, which is the most recent album I've made, which was a solo record, it was very emotional. It was written in a time after my mother died. And, you know, I was really proud of it. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't operate on the same level that the Hold Steady does. I hope it will at some point, but you know, it people do say, oh, that's a solo thing, or that's not as exciting. And you know, in some sort of lame MBA way, you might say it doesn't have the brand. And it also doesn't have the put your fist in the air thing that might be escapist and fun for people. It might not be as fun for sure. But so you want it to operate. You don't want, yeah, I mean, you very much want to say like, this is every bit as worthy. I put the same amount of effort into it. I put the same amount of thought into it. But it's also realistically, you understand why, you know, I mean, there's also the rock fan in me that says like, you know, what the solo album, you know, is not, I've been on that side of it. And I get it. You're thinking like, well, why is it a solo album? Why do we need, you know, and even if the band's broken up, you know, it's like, is it Joe Strummer solo album, which that's a bad example because those are great albums. Yeah. But the first one was like less exciting than The Clash, you know, or Earthquake Weather. Yeah. And you're like, well, I just wish it could be. But I mean, that's kind of being a rock fan anyways. You also kind of wish you were in college and Check Your Head just came out, you know?
Right.
That's, you know.
Well, I would say with you too, the difference with like a lot of solo records is it seems like the lead singer, like there's examples of like lead singers going off and they make a record that just sounds like the band.
Right.
You know, and your records certainly do not sound like Hold Steady records. I think that was doubly true of Faith in the Future, which sonically had a lot of things going on that go far beyond sort of the like straight ahead rock and roll thing. And that, I'm guessing that was obviously deliberate on your part. You wanted to explore that a little bit more.
Deliberate. And yeah. And in that case, in Faith in the Future, it was really, you know, me getting the songs in my kitchen up to where I could get them to, you know, and then really working with Josh Kaufman, the producer, to say like, how could these be better? And what are you hearing? And getting a new ear on it and you know, some things that I wouldn't have thought of, you know, I mean, and things that, you know, were new for me. Like there's one song he said, okay, well now sing over your vocal the whole thing in falsetto. And, you know, he put it really far down that you wouldn't even notice. It's almost like an effect. But that's something in the Hold Steady I wouldn't have done. You know, I wouldn't have thought of that myself. There's a lot of sonic stuff that he did and he encouraged us all to do that was way different. And I think, you know, it all that stuff leads to growth, I think. You know, whether people, some people want growth, some people don't, you know. I mean, I love the Ramones and I love AC/DC too. So
yeah.
It's like sometimes those bands are the ones that have a lot of staying power. You know?
Yeah.
But you also have to keep yourself entertained and artistically. Artistically rewarded internally, and the fact is like, you know, I'm 44 years old, so how I feel when I'm writing these songs is different, you know, maybe than when I was writing at least the words for Almost Killed Me.
Yeah. I mean,
and I feel like with fans of yours too, I mean, like fans have obviously made connections in your songs or they found the connections that you've made yourself. I mean, do you see your solo work like existing in the same universe as like those Hold Steady songs?
I think I've kind of deliberately tried to create a different universe. Yeah. I feel like, I mean, the Hold Steady is, they're my best friends. So there's something I have to, I'm almost like hyper conscious of being very, trying to keep them separate. And the fact is I don't write much music in the Hold Steady. I write mainly the words. So, you know, you're at the solo show and someone requests Stuck Between Stations. It's like, well, not only can't we do that physically, we don't know how to play it, but it's not right. It just wouldn't be right for me to be out here touring around playing, you know, what amounts to other people's music. It's partly mine, but not all. So,
is that something you've just kind of decided on your own, or has the band said to you, hey man, don't be playing our shit?
No. That's something I decided on my own. And we've done certain songs, which is, I joke that is one I wrote the music to also, but it's like C, F, and G. It's the most, you know, straightforward chord progression there is. So
yeah.
And there are a few of those, and you can probably tell if you were a big Hold Steady fan which ones I wrote the music for, because they're very similar to that one. But you know, I think it's a matter of being respectful, and as you create a body of work with the solo stuff, you know, pretty soon I'll be three albums deep, yeah. And there's plenty of songs to choose from.
Well, tell me a bit about this third record. I mean, it sounds like, from what you were saying before, it's maybe like a continuation of Faith in the Future in a way. Like,
yeah, I would say it's a continuation. It's produced by Josh Kaufman and Joe. With Faith in the Future, we made it with really three musicians: myself, Josh, and Joe Russo played drums. All those people were involved for this one, but we expanded it. We had Sam Kassir play piano and John Shaw play bass. And Stuart Bogie, who's a great horn player, and Jordan McLean, who played with a lot with like Antibalas and a lot of people, played a lot. There's a lot of horns and a lot of piano. So I'd say sonically, maybe it's like Faith in the Future, but maybe leaning a little more musical and leaning towards a little more horns and piano. A lot of this story, they're very much a story-oriented record. I don't have a title for it yet, the record, so I can't refer to it like that. I've been calling it CFLP3. It's stories, and I think it's stories as it continues to be, as my work continues to be, and what I think I'm most interested in is stories about adults. When I made the first solo record, Clear Heart, Full Eyes, was down in Austin making it, and I rented a car. I don't drive in New York, so it's always an opportunity to listen to the radio, something I never do. And yeah. Because I was in Texas, I started listening to like pop country radio.
Yeah.
And I was really blown away by how many songs there were on that station that dealt with real things. There was one about a woman who had breast cancer. There was songs about people who had children in Iraq.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's really cool. I mean, that's, you know, that's something to relate to. And maybe I think that's something that rock songs, I mean, certainly Bruce Springsteen does that, but rock songs don't always do that. And I think that that's something that I'm really interested in right now. So I think like this record is a lot about how people partner up to get through or get by. And whether that's dependency or codependency or love, there's examples of all three.
Yeah.
Was that the moment that you kind of turned the page on that? Because I think when people think about like Hold Steady songs, they think a lot about songs about adolescence and or being in your 20s. Mm-hmm. And this transition to writing about adults and adult themes and like a stories with adults in them. I mean, was that something you felt like, well, this is the territory I want to carve out in my own songs? Or, I mean, was it that moment in the car listening to pop country?
I don't know. I was impressed by that. I think I've always had kind of a 15-year gaze back, and now I'm 15 years older, and my 15-year gaze is landing on 29 and 30, you know?
Right.
It's wanting to stay honest. And I think when we started the Hold Steady, I thought, you know, I was probably 31 when we started, but 33 when we were making, like, you know, I think we were Separation Sunday. Well, 33, yeah, I was 33.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about what was 19 like? With a little distance, what was being 19 like? How scary was it? How funny was it? You know, et cetera. And now I think I can do that about 29 or 30. And that's an age where people are sort of, you know, I guess your 30s are sort of an age where you kind of are, things are either happening or they're not happening.
Yeah.
And there's some big decisions to be made. And I find that really interesting.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this on the way over here, actually, because, you know, like a big theme in Hold Steady songs is community and trying to find a community and foster a community. But like part of getting older sometimes is pulling yourself out of a community and isolating yourself, and because you have a family or maybe you have a career or whatever. And, you know, for you, like, do you find yourself doing that? And is that a change that you, and if so, is that a change that you welcome, or is that something you have to fight against?
Well, I mean, I think some part of the Hold Steady, the first few records, and I'm hyper aware of it right now because we're remastering and re-releasing Almost Killed Me and Separation Sunday on vinyl.
Oh.
So I've been approving a remaster of those two records recently, so I'm spending a lot of time with them. And I really hear, I mean, I hear, I'm really, I love those records, and I've been falling in love with them over. You know, you don't listen to yourself. You don't put on, I don't put on Almost Killed Me, but if I have to approve a master, I'm spending all this time with it. I'm like, oh, I really love this. And God, it sounds, it's revisiting something from 2004, and I sound really, I don't know, angry is the right word, but belligerent in some way, you know? It's a feeling I don't feel belligerent that often. And I think I was at that time, I think as a band, part of the personality was, all right, we're not going to grow up, or we're not, you know, and I'd been married and it wasn't maybe going so hot. And I was like, you know, I don't know if I want to have a job, and I don't want a mortgage. What I want to do is be in a rock band. And, you know, I'm supposed to be like not be in a rock band now and start all that other stuff. But no, like I want to do this. And we did it. And there was something fulfilling about that. I think songs come from a different place now. And I don't feel that belligerence. I've found love. I've sort of found acceptance, which isn't to say I hope that doesn't mean your songs have to suck. But, you know, there's a less anger and, you know, maybe a different way of looking at things.
I mean, is that a fear that you have? I mean, you've kind of touched on that a little bit a couple times in the interview about, like, well, you've obviously embraced this period in your career, like where you're writing more adult-oriented songs, but do you also worry that, like, well, people won't dig it as much, or like, because I'm not as angry anymore? Like you just said, like, I hope that doesn't suck because doing that. I mean, is that something you are conscious of when you're writing these songs? Like, do you worry, like, oh, I'm turning into Sting or something? Right. Is that something you worry about?
Again, I'm conscious of it as a fan. Yeah. You know, my friend had a joke that, like, if you ever hear a rock band that and the song is about the singer's like new baby, that album for sure sucks, and I think that's true, you know.
That's how maybe you felt at a certain age. Maybe when you're older, you revisit those records and you're like, hey, that.
Yeah.
I have a baby now. I kind of relate to that. So, maybe is the record better or are you lamer at that point? I don't know.
I don't know, but you know. Maybe I mean there's a school of thought. I mean, when I was 19, what I thought a 44-year-old singing rock roll, I don't know, a rock and roll record, I don't know if I thought that was a good thing.
Right.
But it's sort of my reaction to my life now, you know. It's like I write songs and I do think there's an audience for it, and I believe in it, but it's probably, I will admit, it's not as cathartic as Constructive Summer, you know. It's probably, you know,
it's cathartic in a different way. I mean, like, when I listen to Tunnel of Love now, I relate to that in a way that I couldn't have related to it when I was 18. And I actually think, I mean, I thought the record was, I was such a Springsteen fan that I loved that record then, but like, I don't know. I do think that idea that, like, rock and roll just has to be that kind of teenage belligerent thing is, like, limiting. I like that I can, it's like, okay, he's singing, like, I can hear those songs that Springsteen wrote when he was in his late 30s, which is where I'm at now. And I'm like, okay, I understand, like, where you're coming from here. And there's a honesty and a depth to it just as much as there's an honesty and depth to, this, like, the songs I'm Born to Run or something.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that's, I do think that's true, and I do, but I, you know, I think being realistic, maybe it's more likely, these songs are more likely to connect with people who have had some life experience,
right.
You know, yeah. And you might not expect a 14-year-old to be like, Tunnel of Love, this is way better than Born to Run.
Right.
I'd be happy if a 14-year-old was listening to Born to Run. Yeah, I mean, that'd be pretty awesome.
At this point, we'd be happy. We'd take what we can get, right? but, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, for me, rock and roll does a lot of things. And when I was 16, 14, you know, a song like 16 Blue or unsatisfied was cathartic's not the right word, but helpful.
Yeah.
And touching, and that was that did a lot for me. Even though it's on the and on the same side of the record, Gary's Got a Boner was cool too.
Right.
You know, and
right.
both felt good right. in different ways. But you know, 16 Blue was sort of a message that someone else understands. And I think music can do that.
Yeah, you were saying that you've been listening to the first two Hold Steady records a lot mm-hmm. lately, and. It's interesting because I feel like on those first two records, in a way, what you were doing was almost like a postmodern version of classic rock, where it was like commenting on it, and it was sort of like a punk rock thing to it. And then on the next two records, it kind of became classic rock in a way, or at least that's how people reacted to you. They would compare you to classic rock a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, like, what were your feelings about that at the time, or even now looking back on it? Like, did you have any... trepidation about that as a kid who loved punk rock growing up? Like, was there part of you that thought, like, well, I don't want to be compared to Bob Seger or stuff like that? Or did you embrace that?
I think we embraced it, and I did not yet. It was, so I think, like, when I'm trying to make sense of, like, the time, or I know the timeline, but so I was in Lifter Puller, and but we were always kind of, we were into the punk stuff, you know, obviously, but we were always kind of into, like, Bob Seger, you know, like, we were kind of in the Midwestern, like, we liked Springsteen, and we liked, I don't think it was ironic, but it was definitely, like, this is cool. You know, we were into that movie Over the Edge. We were really right. into that, you know, right. we were into, like, dirt bike guys, and just Midwestern, like, you know, scummy stuff. And
like Cheap Trick
and Cheap
songs.
Trick songs were huge. And AC/DC. And, like, and so, in the time off, and also I was always into punk and indie. And by the end of my 20s, indie just, I remember just feeling it had disappointed me.
Right.
It had just, I'd done it all. I'd done it, and I'd just sort of, not as participating in an indie rock band, but just the whole thing. Like, I just decided, like, these people aren't that kick-ass.
Right.
You know? Like, they aren't that fun. It's right. more about, like, going to a show that no one's at and then bragging about it later. And it's just not it's not great people, you know? Like, it's just not the people I wanted to surround myself with. So, and then I, you know, just sort of in the cheapo record bins, we'd been kind of just buying all this classic rock stuff and geeking out on it, you know,
yeah.
You know, Grand Funk Railroad and things like that, and finding that it was kind of more fun, and having fun became more important. So yeah, we sort of could do what we could do. Tad's obviously an amazing guitar player, so he had these big riffs, and yeah, we were kind of doing. I think we were kind of growing into it, meaning. You know, he'd do the riffs and I'd yell over it, and yeah. Eventually got a little better at singing. And then when we added Franz, you know, we had the piano, so it sort of opened up this, like, real depth of, like, wow, we can do, like, on Separation Sunday, we had the Stevie Nicks or the big piano breakdown. It's kind of like, wow, we can do that. Like, we have a really good piano player in the band. We can do stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I think it wasn't, and also we were by that point, we were moving very fast, like. So I don't think it was a it wasn't something we thought a lot about. It just was sort of a quick but natural progression into. And also, you know, the first two records we made with our friends, and there's producers, I guess. But, you know, Almost Kill Me was made, including mixing, in 6 days. So, you know, the third record, Boys and Girls America, was made in like 30 days with John Agnello.
Yeah.
Was a very strong producer and you know, kind of helped us get more realized. But in some ways, I think it felt fairly natural.
Yeah.
Although we did think about, I guess there was more talk about, like, well, is there a chorus there? You know, I mean, the first two records, there's not really choruses. There's
right.
Different parts, and I sing different things over all of them.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was thinking about this. I always feel like there's choruses on those records, but there's not. There's a way, they're like phantom choruses almost.
Yeah, and that's similar to Lifter Puller.
Yeah.
where there's a part that you would say generally would be the chorus, except I don't sing the same thing over it.
Right.
So it goes back to it, and you're familiar with it, except the lyrics don't reference. But they might kind of the top of the chorus might start with the same line, but then get very different. And that was just a trick. I don't know. That was just what I did, you know? And then around the time of...
Hood Rat Friend, that was on Separation Sunday, right?
Yeah.
That has a chorus. That's kind of like the transition track maybe into Boys and Girls in America.
Yeah, I think that that's correct. I think that that's almost like the blueprint for the sound of Boys and Girls in America in some way, you know?
Right.
That was the leanest and catchiest and most memorable. I think, like, you know, at some point I get the idea, and I don't think it's incorrect, that if you repeat yourself, or if you, you know, not ad nauseum, but if you repeat yourself a little bit, maybe people remember it a little more,
yeah.
You know, or have something a little to grab onto.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, like, you know, Franz coming into the band with Separation Sunday, and we were talking a little bit before I started recording about these dates you're going to be doing in the fall, the 10th anniversary shows for Boys and Girls in America, and Franz is going to be in the band, but just for those shows.
Well, yeah, I mean, right now, the whole city, we haven't played in like 18 months, and so we have these shows coming up, and we decided to play a limited amount of shows to celebrate the anniversary, and we asked if Franz wanted to join for those shows, and he said, sure. So we're doing Denver, Chicago, Toronto, and then these three shows in Brooklyn. And right now, that's all sort of like we have on the Hold Steady docket. We're open to playing more. I think, like, what happened was when we announced that we were going to play, and it was carefully worded, a limited amount of shows, you know, that quickly on the internet becomes Hold Steady's going on tour. And certainly my social media would support the idea that some people are expecting a tour. But we are definitely I'm into playing more shows. I think the band is. We'll have to talk to Franz if he is. But right now, those are the shows we have. I hope there'll be more because I love doing it. But they have to make sense with, you know, we haven't played in 18 months. Everyone's doing their own things. And we're all in our 40s now. So they kind of have to make sense. They can't be just getting in a van and heading west and hitting every little town.
You're not going to do like a 6-month trek across the world?
Yeah, that's not going to happen. But I certainly hope we'll play shows in all the places that it makes sense in the way we can. And in the meantime, I do think that Denver, Chicago, Toronto, and New York are fantastic places to visit. And those are great places for people to see Hold Steady play. So, I hope we'll do more. But that's what's on the docket for now.
Were you surprised by the reaction when that was announced? Because there was a lot of excitement when people heard that you were going to be playing some shows with Franz. Like, were you taken aback at all by that?
Not at all. I mean, I think the band is, you know, I think, I talk to the fans, and I think a lot of people miss the piano. A lot of people miss Franz himself, and for good reason. He's an amazing performer. I miss the piano. I miss Franz. I miss that the piano is a part of the sound of the Hold Steady, that I like singing with it. But that said, when Franz left, we got Steve Selvage in the band, who became, you know, part of the family.
Yeah.
So these are now a 6-piece band, which now makes that even more difficult, you know, to go around the country.
You could be like the Allman Brothers.
Well, that's what it's turning into, but I'm really excited about it. I mean, I'm not surprised at all that people are excited about Franz's return. He was a part of, you know, what I think most people think are our best records, and a big part of the sound, and a great performer and a great person. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's a long time coming, and I think it's going to be really celebratory, which I think is what a good Hold Steady show is.
Yeah.
I mean, you said something interesting before about how you said that you feel like a lot of fans associate Franz with, like, their favorite records mm-hmm. in the band. I mean, is that something that that you kind of grudgingly accept in a way that fans look at it that way? Is that at all, like, annoying at all? Like, when people ask you about this guy who's not in the band anymore, you know, like, how do you deal with that?
I mean, to be frank, they're my favorite records too. I think it's, if you're going to stick around, you know, I think it's hard to not, you know, have people's favorite records be, you know, one of your first four.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think like when you think about most bands, like I'm, you know, I'm just take, a band I love is the Afghan Whigs. And, but I think a lot of people will say Gentleman's their favorite record, right?
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with the records after that, but that's my favorite Afghan Whigs record, but the other ones are great.
Yeah.
I love them, you know, and I'm not bummed. And I, but I think, you know, there's always that one or two that are connecting, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's going to be, you know, I know, like, I listened to your record, your interview with Beachline.
Yeah.
Like that band to me, when I look at them and I saw them in Atlanta and I saw them in Brooklyn, I think like that's kind of where Boys and Girls was at, you know?
Right.
It's very similar. It's positive. The audience feels very a part of it. Now, five records in, you know, are people, you know, that's a tough thing to think about,
right?
You know?
Well,
I mean, I feel like a lot of people think about that with Japan Droids right now. You know, Celebration Rock was another one where it's, yeah, it's this sort of defining rock record, and it has very much about adolescence and, you know, living for today and all that. And that's a hard thing to follow up. Like, where do you go from that? You can't really do that again necessarily, but like, then do you make the mature record after that? I mean, you know, you've had to deal with that yourself. I mean, talk about that process. That is kind of a difficult thing to move on from, isn't it?
I mean, I think about Heaven as Whenever, which is, you know, I think it has some redeeming qualities, but it's my least favorite Hold Steady record.
Yeah.
And it was made at a time that was maybe tough for us. People were going through some things, and it just, I also feel like a little bit at a loss for what I was to say. It wasn't we're not growing up, we can still party. It wasn't throw your beers in the air. I mean, it just felt like that had been done. I couldn't, you know,
right.
It couldn't be drunk in Minneapolis. You know, like that song had been written. That album had been written a few times.
Right.
You know, we're still drunk in Minneapolis. That doesn't, I know that doesn't connect. So you're trying to do something, and when I look back, I don't really think I knew what I was doing. And I also, it's hard to explain what I thought I was doing. But it has something to do with my sense of humor, and it just didn't work.
Do you feel like it doesn't work because of the reaction to it? Or do you feel like the record itself, like you weren't happy with it? Like, were you happy with it at the time? Like when you made it?
I couldn't tell because I was in it, but we weren't having fun when we made it, which is the first Hold Steady record, or the only Hold Steady record that I could say that about. So it doesn't sound fun to me.
It's just like exhaustion, basically, at that point?
Yeah, exhaustion. It was probably a big part of it. Franz had left, and I think we didn't know. I don't know that, in hindsight, I definitely don't think we knew what to do then. or maybe we didn't. We thought it mattered less than it did, maybe.
Yeah.
And there may have been people telling us that. But you know, there's some, I think, Sweet Part of the City on that record I really like. I like The Weekenders a lot. But I got really freaked out by the fact that it was our fifth album, and I felt like, I didn't feel like an underdog maybe anymore. But I didn't know what to say. And it came off, that album sounds self-righteous to me. There's a lot of songs that I feel like, you know, like there's this, as an example, it's an Elvis song, Little Sister, Don't You Do What Your Big Sister Does.
Right.
That whole, there's these like advice songs in the history of rock and roll, and I got really into them. And I thought like, and my joke at the time was the Cosmic Philosopher, which is like kind of a Jerry Garcia kind of guy who kind of imports this sort of weird hippie front porch wisdom. And we were joking around a lot about that. And all those songs seem like I'm trying to like give advice to my little brother that I don't have. And I was in no position to be giving advice to anyone. And it's that album sounds weirdly, from a lyrical standpoint, self-righteous to me.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't like. And there's also a song on Teeth Dreams called Wait a While that's continuation of that that kind of irks me too, even though I wrote it, obviously. But I look back and that's something I'm trying, like, in the last two solo records, I've really tried to, like, take a step back and pass no judgment.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I was doing before, but then I got in this weird, I don't know, headspace or something that, and I think it was because I didn't know what I should be saying.
Yeah. I mean,
I feel like in a way, when you really love a band, that those, because I know that there will be people listening to this podcast who are going to say, I love that record. How can he say that? Yeah. And in a way, the record that maybe people don't love as much, it gets adopted by like the really hardcore fans, you know, and then they were like, no, this is the real shit. If you really like this band, you know, you're going to love this, you know, you're going to love this record the most.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I love Van Morrison and
yeah.
I mean, I go to the record store and I feel like if I'm going to use record store every time I see a Van Morrison record I didn't know existed, then I always buy it. And you're like, come home and you're like, well, there are some great moments on that. And I love Van Morrison, so I'm glad I bought that record, you know? But if you're building a body of work, it can't all be your Born to Run, you know?
Right.
And at some point you have to say, like, maybe Boys and Girls in America was our Born to Run, or Separation Sunday was.
Yeah.
And the rest is like us, you know, just continuing on and doing the best we can and saying what we have to say and believing in it and making music that we believe in for our people. And maybe that seems cool, you know? And it may be, you know, I love Magic by Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, yeah.
You know? But, you know, hopefully you get to your magic.
Right.
It's not Born to Run, maybe, but it's a different thing.
Or, you know, for me, I've had this thing where I was listening. Yeah, Jason Isbell did a tweet like a year ago or something where he said that Ghost of Tom Joad was his favorite Springsteen record. And to me, that was like throwing down the gauntlet because I'm like, I don't, that's probably my least favorite Bruce Springsteen record, but like Jason Isbell says it's his favorite. So I'm going to listen to this record as many times as it takes for me to see what he sees in it. And in a way, that is more enjoyable than putting on Born to Run again or Darkness, even though those are better records and I love them more. But I'm not going to discover anything on those records anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Dylan's another example. Like, you know, you probably aren't going to get blood on the tracks again, but, you know, there you can go back to that record in the 80s that you didn't listen to and be like, well, that was awesome.
Right.
That first side, at least, is incredible,
like,
you know?
Like, have you heard like Knocked Out Loaded at all?
Yeah.
Like, just like the list of musicians on that record, because it's like Kip Winger is on a track with like it's just like the weirdest assemblage of musicians.
Yeah.
Like whoever was like walking through the studio, it's like, oh yeah, play on this Dylan track.
Yeah, and at some point you're looking for that magic in a way that like Dylan has that. I think when you, especially being 44, sticking around, being 20 years in, you know, rock and roll, you're like, well, that's really, you know, he's keeping it loose and he's writing these songs and he's letting things happen to him, you know, kind of. And, you know, they, in the Rolling Thunder, they sound one way, and then on the album, they sound another, and now they sound completely different.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting. And I think part of that is also to keep yourself entertained, keeping him keeping himself entertained, right?
Yeah.
I think that's important rather than going out and playing, having to play those 15 hits.
Or worrying about making the perfect record every time. Because, like, especially when you're a guy like that, because it's like, he must have realized at some point that if he had died in 1967, his place in history was always was already secure. But it's like, well, I didn't die in 1967.
Yeah.
So I'm living for like 50 years plus after that. So what am I going to do? I'm going to just keep doing whatever comes into my head. And
yeah. And I think actually with the Holt study, that was something we actually very much talked about at the beginning of the band, because we put out records quickly.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm not Guided by Voices quickly, but quickly.
Almost, though.
Almost.
Like a year is like a record a year.
One year. And that's what I'm trying to do with the solo thing now, which is every year basically be documented by a record. And with that, you don't have to make a masterpiece. You know, it's almost like, you can say, hey, we've got 10 new songs. Want to hear them?
Right.
And I think that that's maybe, it takes pressure off yourself.
Yeah.
And I think it allows, people consume music so quickly too now. I think it's good for your fans. And, you know, you don't want, you know, I love Japandroids, for instance, you know, like I'm anxious for their next record.
Yeah.
But it's been a while now. So you're like,
yeah,
what's it going to be like? You know, and you're, you know, I wish I had their last record, next record a year ago.
Yeah.
You know, and right. I mean, on the same things, I think Beachlang's coming out with one quickly. And that's,
right.
I think that's great. I think that's, you know.
You almost need to put out the follow-up right away so it can just take the bullets, you know. Because I think with your band, too, you mentioned how on Heaven is Whenever you felt like you were a little bit unsure of what to say. It also seemed like the band had reached a point maybe critically where no matter what you were going to do at that point, it was probably not going to be in your favor necessarily. I mean, was that something you also kind of sensed, maybe?
Oh, I knew that, you know, and we don't, you know, I don't think we have the you know, we weren't going to do Kid A, you know? I mean, yeah. That was not appropriate nor possible.
Yeah. I mean, if you put out, like, four records that people love, it's like, are we going to love the fifth record? That's kind of a boring thing to do.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, well, you know, it's like they're doing the thing.
Yeah.
And we loved it before, but maybe we're not as sure anymore. You know,
yeah.
That's kind of a stock response, I think.
Yeah, and it very much is. And I also think, and again, I come at it as an artist, but also as a fan, it's fun to find new things.
Right.
You know? So it's like, all right, their fifth album, or what about this new band? Like,
right.
That's exciting. Look at
right.
them, you know? Like, and I think that's part of what you're dealing with too, you know?
But like,
what about AC/DC and the Ramones? Like, how, like, do they get away with, like with what they do and not changing? And like if AC/DC made like an acoustic folk record or something, it would be awful. Like you want them to make the same record over and over again. Like what is it about those bands you think that allows them to do that? Because it is sort of a unique exemption from that those bands get.
Well, I think their fans find something like comforting or steady, you know, in it. And it's something like no surprises, you know. And I mean, with AC/DC, it's even like almost like the song titles, like, and the, you know, or like didn't they already do that? I have to go back and check, you know.
Well, like the Bon Scott years, they made like six records, I think, that are virtually the same, but like in a way they got better, like each record, like Power Ridge and Highway to Hell, like by the time they were getting to that era, you know, they had kind of honed it perfectly without really, like they evolved within a very narrow framework, you know, where the songs didn't change that much, they kind of got slicker maybe, but I don't know. It's like a very, I feel like most bands do not get that benefit of the doubt. It's like if you make that record over and over again, you know, critics come after you or fans maybe get bored, but
right.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, it's hard to know. I think they may have both benefited from coming up at a certain time,
yeah.
You know? And there is a little bit like, that's how we used to do it. That's how it's done. Back in the day, that was, you know, good old rock and roll. Now
right.
It's this, you know, I think there's some of that. Although, you know, I mean, the Ramones, like, there's so many records, and they're so similar, really. I mean,
yeah.
And I love them all, really. But I think there's the con. There's something about that whole, I don't know, they both have looks very, you know, very like Angus Young, looks the, you know, he's wearing the schoolboy outfit still. The Ramones
yeah.
had that. So I think there's something that people appreciate about that.
Yeah, it's sort of like
buying the, like when you buy Oreos or something, you don't want the Oreos to be different. You want them to be the way they were when you were a kid or whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, in some ways you're like, I don't, you see on TV the ads where they have like new pizza that they put, like there's dipping sauces and there's cheese in the crust. And it's like, pizza was kind of undefeated already. Like there's just
right.
not much, I can't imagine like why you're needing to, you know, screw with this. And so maybe pizza's the Ramones and the stuffed crust is something else,
yeah,
you know,
right.
that we don't need.
So we were, you know, talking again about these 10th anniversary dates for Boys and Girls in America. Like, do you feel like that's the best Hold Steady record? Like, do you have an opinion on that?
You know, at times I do. I guess if you asked me 4 months ago, I would have said yes. And then I had just been listening to Almost Killed Me and Step Sunday a ton because the remasters. And I actually think right now my answer is that Almost Killed Me is the best Hold Steady record. And I think that at some point, on some level, that a band's first album is in some ways almost going to be the best. Because it's like a statement of purpose. It's a statement of their intention. And like, I just think, like, looking back, that, like, you know, the fact that, and we didn't know where it was going to go at the time, but looking back on you know, six LPs and 12-year career, or maybe more now, to start it with a positive jam, I'm really glad we made that decision. You know, like that's how it starts. Like, it's like a good, it's a statement of purpose.
I remember the first time I heard Boys and Girls in America, the thing that leapt out at me was like, okay, they're doing clearly defined choruses. It sounds cleaner. The songs are more compact. I mean, was there ever a thought, I mean, because you kind of started this band, I mean, it seems like from what I've read that, it, you know, the band kind of started on a lark in a way. Like, we're just going to do this and it's going to be fun. And certainly the first two records aren't necessarily anyone's idea of like radio-friendly rock. Right. But like, was there any idea in your head that, like, well, maybe we will chase that with this record and kind of try to get on K-Rock or whatever it would be? Or, I mean, or was it something where you were moving so fast you couldn't even think about that sort of stuff?
I mean, it wasn't like K-Rock, but it was sort of like, why don't we challenge ourselves to do something we haven't done?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I can't say this for sure, but I think that our attitude at the time was like, we'll try it on this one. If we don't like it, we don't do it next time, you know?
Yeah.
But there was we wouldn't have known about sort of a lot of the stuff, the industry stuff up till then. You know what I mean? Like, we wouldn't have known what to shoot for or what we were shooting for.
Mm-hmm.
We were just doing it, you know? But I think we were also, I'm pretty sure we realized we were on the precipice of something exciting. Because Separation Sunday had been well-received, and people were showing up at the shows, and they were selling out. And it was something like we'd never experienced before. We were driving around this, like, terrible white box truck, and it was all very exciting. And it felt like, I mean, it was, like, very, very exciting. And I didn't know what to make of it, you know? I mean, I remember generally being, throughout those years, starting with Separation Sunday, where you'd show up and it'd be like there'd be a sold out sign, and you'd say, "Who are all these people, and what are they going to be doing here?" You know,
yeah.
And it was very exciting. So I think Boys and Girls was a way to try to connect bigger, and we were very from the get go into community and also being into accessible. Like I said, I've been so disappointed by indie.
Yeah.
That I wanted to do something that, like, was big and, you know, for lack of better terms, Midwestern. But,
yeah.
You know, that, like, you know, people who bought their records at Target could say, I'm into this. This sounds, you know, comforting in some way, or sounds like something I'm into. It's not like something on a 7-inch you can't get.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about that transition because, again, you, I mean, Lifter Puller was very much a part of that indie scene, and you know, I know you growing up, you know, being into hardcore and even being into a band like The Replacements, who signed to a major label, but you know, later, you know, but you know, when they were the Twin Tone years, they were still a pretty obscure band. I mean, was there like a galvanizing moment, I guess, for you in that regard, where it was like, oh, I'm sick of this indie stuff, and I want to embrace something maybe a little broader.
There's this one thing about Lifter Puller that I keep going back to or think about, that I think we were more rock and roll people in some way than a lot of the indie bands we were around. Like, we were more into, like, you know, drugs and alcohol and girls, you know, like, and that stuff, like, indie was like, I don't know, like, yeah, let's have a, you know, like, but like, it was, you know, we were feral. And so it got kind of frustrating, like, oh, these guys, you know, and it'd be, you know, like these guys are like, you know, like you'd go to the indie rock party after the show and it would just be, you know, tame. And, so I think that there was something there. Like, I think I wanted more rock and roll.
Yeah.
for some reason, this memory just flashed into my brain. I remember the first time I went to San Francisco, and I went to a party with my friend, and I realized how much faster I was drinking than everybody else. And then I was like, okay, I really am like a Midwestern guy. Because I never felt like I was that big of a drinker, because my friends could always drink way more than me. But you're just used to like being, like when I drink with other Midwesterners, we always just drink really fast, and then you open another one immediately.
Yeah.
And when I would be with those people, they would just kind of cradle it for like an hour and a half, like one drink, and then I was like, what?
This girl I knew came out and visited us that we'd met through Lifter Puller, and she was visiting us in Minneapolis, and she was at a table at the Triple Rock, and she said she'd never seen the ordering when your drink isn't done yet.
Right.
You know, by the time you come back, I'll need another. And she said, we don't do that, you know?
Well, I appreciated, like, you offered me a beer when I got here, and then you put another beer right next to it
right
away. I was like, okay.
Yeah, I figure we're going to talk, and we don't want to interrupt, you know? I mean, but yeah, I think that I did. It's funny to think about that is the Lifter Puller to the years between Lifter Puller and the first Old State record were definitely in some way kind of a rejection of that indie thing. And a love for ridiculous. Like, we were really into we would go on tour with the whole state. We were really into, like, the first Boston record. Like, we would just listen to that. And that rock and roll band, you know, when there's, like, a crowd that cheers, we loved that. Like the fake crowd and, like, rolling into Hyannis. Like, we would go crazy to things like that. And obviously Thin Lizzy, but that's a little more obvious, you know, like, of course we were into that, but we were into, like, you know, like, those were the records we wouldn't play. Archers of Loaf, I like Archers of Loaf, but, like, that's not, like, what we were listening to, you know. We were listening to Cheap Trick and you know, infusing it with our own small do-it-yourself kind of thing.
Well, and what's amazing now is that, like, indie rock doesn't really even exist, or it doesn't seem to exist. There's still punk and emo, and that's kind of like where the real indie rock is, I think. But when you talk about indie rock, it's not rock music really anymore. It doesn't seem like.
No, I mean, rock is not at its peak right now. Let's be honest. It doesn't seem like it's, the kids aren't into it, and it's weird. I mean, you know, I'm 44 and emo, like, the, you know, I try to keep up on things, and I saw this, there's an emo revival.
Yeah.
I mean, this is sounding like Get Off My Lawn, but I was like, oh my God, you're kidding me. Like, you know? And, because I remember being a little conflicted about emo the first time around, and there were certainly bands I liked. But I will say that, like, if we're going to have an emo revival, why, to me, the Promise Ring is the band you would celebrate the most, you know, from that, because I really like that.
I feel like a lot of those bands too, like the ones that I've talked to, like they get classified as emo, but their reference points are not emo records. Like, a lot of times it's like classic rock records, and they liked punk and they like classic rock, and they're kind of merging it into this thing. And there's like this underground of kids who really like it, and. Because I disagree. I think that there are kids who like guitar music. It's just that the media is not paying attention to them. And in a way, I wonder if that's a good thing. I used to always like kind of rail against this, but then I heard an interview with Patrick Stickles, and I thought he made a great point where he said that, like, well, maybe it's time now for rock to be the underground thing again, where it's not in the media anymore, and it's embraced by people who are sort of rejected by the mainstream or who don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And that might be the way forward for it.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that. There's also, like, there is, like, this ultimate super classification, and there's, like, you know, at my age, I think I know what I like. So I see a band be called emo or pop punk.
Yeah.
I'm not interested, right?
Right.
And then someone I really like, I'd seen that term used to describe modern baseball, and then a friend of mine who I know is my taste said, no, you should listen to this record, and I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
I think that song Mass is like one of the best songs I've heard in years, but, like, I wouldn't have listened to it because I thought it was emo pop punk.
Right.
Right. Like, I was like, that's not for someone my age, right? But it is. That's the music I like. That's guitar music with good lyrics.
Right, exactly.
So I think you're right. I think there's this, like, overly classified, I think you're right, saying emo or whatever just means guitars,
yeah.
You know?
That's kind of, because I feel like indie rock became this term that just became a catch-all for anything that, like, Pitchfork wrote about or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it really didn't come from like a rock lineage necessarily, it's sort of like, well, you know, this is what we're going to call indie rock. It's sort of like what hip underground music is. And I feel like with emo now, that's sort of what you call underground rock music.
Yeah, two guitars, bass, and drums is emo now, I guess.
Right. Like, I feel like if the Hold Steady put out Almost Killed Me, you would be called an emo band, probably.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know, because for an older guy like me to be able to break through to buy new stuff, maybe I'm really into emo.
Towns Van Zandt is emo.
Yeah.
Call him emo, too.
Emo's emotional. And emo, like, meant Rites of Spring at one point, so...
Yeah.
I've lived through three waves of emo now, I guess.
Before I let you go, I have to ask, too, you know, you have the third solo record coming out next year. Are there any plans to do a Hold Steady record? Have you guys talked about that at all?
We haven't, but, you know, I mean, I think the first thing is to play these shows, and if there's momentum and songs, we'll, you know, do that.
And you're definitely doing a six-month tour. Right? Right? You're doing 50 shows every state.
You know, it's, my favorite thing on social media is like, you know, when you announce you're, okay, we're going to do Riot Fest Denver, and then you get a whole list of play St. Louis, play Omaha, play Oklahoma City, play, like, that's like what all the fans, like, that's a thing that everyone writes after. Yeah. But then started to get really specific. Like, you'll get play Miami on a Saturday. So I will do this. I will now promise that we play every city in America only on Saturdays. And if I don't break my, if I break my promise, then I'm sorry. But every, coming to a town, your specific town on a Saturday night.
The Saturday tour, it's going to be like a 3-year tour, I guess, at that point.
Oh, no, it's the rest of our lives. I have Saturday night plans.
Yeah, so
we'll call it the Saturday Night Live tour, and it'll be like surprise shows every time. Like, you know, could be your town, could be your buddy's town, or whatever.
We're only some might only be 3 miles apart.
All right, Craig. Well, hey, it was great talking with you, man. I really appreciate it. All right, that was Craig Finn. Talking Hold Steady, talking his solo record. Again, as he said in our interview, his third record's already in the can. Sounds like that's going to be out next year. Excited to hear that. His solo records are very interesting. They're sort of slow-burning records. Hold Steady records grab you by the throat and drag you along, and you either love them immediately or you don't. But the solo records are slow burners. And if... you haven't listened to Faith in the Future yet, I definitely recommend it. It's the kind of record where when you hear the songs maybe the 10th time, they knock you out with some lyrical detail or sonic accoutrement, if I can use that word, that you didn't notice the first time, and then it knocks you out. So again, that was my conversation with Craig Finn. That was a lot of fun. And I'm so glad you guys checked out another episode of Celebration Rock. You guys make this show possible. And if you like the show, it's always helpful for us if you can help us spread the word. So tell your friends about us, post a review on iTunes, or go on social media and talk about how much you like the show and encourage other people to check it in. That is such a big help for us. So thank you so much for those of you who have already done that. We appreciate all of you. Thank you again for tuning in. This has been Celebration Rock, and we will see you guys again next week.